Well, we're back after Pat's wee holiday abroad, a day early. This is Monday, not Tuesday, and that's because we're going to a St. Patrick's Day bash tomorrow. Got my green on. Yes, we know it's not St. Patrick's Day tomorrow either. So it's a bit of a higgledy-piggledy, topsy-turvy podcast, because that's the world today. A main Radio 4 news programme carried 20 minutes about Kate Middleton fiddling with her pictures and another 20 minutes on Lee Anderson moving to Reform UK, which polled less than half of 1% at the Holyrood elections in 2019. If you want something a little bit more relevant to Scotland, we'll endeavour to get it there for you.
Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi chums, and welcome to the returning Leslie Riddick podcast, and I hope you all enjoyed the special that you got last week on Scotonomics and the festival that's coming up. And I certainly enjoyed my time in Cyprus. It was very relaxing until the last moment, where there was a interesting little time where I'm going to rant about this before I do anything else, because it just symbolised a lot of things that I. Then you can sit there, Leslie, and think, oh yeah, I know where he's coming from this one. So we arrived at 10:20, landed, and we were told, you know, that the bags just weren't there for operational reasons. And that was at 11:15, and we were still standing there. We were getting the bus at 1 minute past 12 back to Dundee. And at 11:15, the plane from Rome arrived. And, you know, we'd been on the ground for an hour, no sign of our bags. And then suddenly, the conveyor belt starts rolling, and on it we see all this rugby union paraphernalia coming through, and all these bags with the names of Scottish rugby union players coming through. And this all comes, and they were landed an hour after us. So you can imagine that I made reference under my breath, sotto voce Joyce, to egg chasing former public schoolboys. But they apparently, where they were standing at the top, it got rather more raucous than that with the Glaswegians, etc. We'd been there. We'd been standing for an hour with kids desperate to get back home. And the bags were coming through. But we did eventually collect our bags. And well done to Mrs. Joyce, because she sprinted with myself to catch the bus at 12. And it was leaving at 12:01. And we did get back to Dundee. So that was it. But there you go. We were bumped to allow the shamefaced Scottish Rugby Union players who just lost to Italy to collect their bags at the head of the queue.
Pat, honestly,
that
is tad curmudgeonly. You know?
Yes, it is.
I do sort of admire your kind of relentless unwillingness to even acknowledge rugby at all.
Malevolence.
Because did you not even have a little frisson when they beat England?
Yeah, I did.
I mean, like a big free song,
it was a nice free song. But I mean, if we'd beaten them at Tiddlywinks or Snooker, it would have been, possibly not as equally free song. But
okay,
yeah,
so all of this proves Pat Joyce is back and he has not been abducted by aliens, right?
And that holiday didn't do my temperament any good.
You sound very perky, actually.
It was terrific. Yeah, but as you said in your tweet, wow, I did choose a time to go away with all what happened. So where we we've got to begin, I think, with Dore Galloway being back in Parliament. And the reaction has been very, very interesting from people whom I admire on the left in England, who seem to be very convinced that this signals a change and George is going to be in there fighting for the left, etc. And the response from people up here in Scotland and from those in the road, down the road who actually know Mr. Galloway, going, dinna hold your breath, pals. He may not be there for very long, and he's not quite the messiah. He may be a very naughty boy, to quote your favourite programmes.
It was quite something to sort of see that, the size of that win. And
wow, yeah.
I mean, to be fair, you know, the guy who came second, who was the independent business campaigner, you know, I mean, that all suggests that there's some, at least in a by-election, again, pretty low turnout, that, you know, the Tories and Labour, you know, were both struggling. Of course, very unusual circumstances there and everything. But yeah, I mean, George, I don't know if you picked up that he challenged, he got, I said, about 3 days of publicity and has now pretty much disappeared again without trace, which is what will keep happening, you know, to independents unless they just do something, you know, radically huge, and we will get on to that with Reform UK, you know, doubtless in a second. But he challenged Jeremy Corbyn to form a new socialist party with him.
Right.
but the thing is, it does all serve, you know, if nobody kind of digs under the surface at all or remembers the sort of long litany of George in different shapes and sizes and, you know, kind of whatever. On the face of it, you know, it would probably look like, yeah, what's Jeremy Corbyn doing in the Labour Party? I mean, what these guys do is pick a tiny fragment that's true. You know, there is obviously a problem for the left in the Labour Party now, and then can join that with their massive egos, and they've got an ostrich, you know. It's there it is, you know, zooming along like Roadrunner, you know, sort of amorphous. No, I'm not going down that analogy anymore. So, yeah, but yes, it's funny, actually, because it was full of the airwaves the day you left and the next day. And now, you know, where is that all gone? I mean, I know this is probably disrupting your process. And we'd have to say that there's so much to cover today that we did plan to do a wee special look at free ports because one of our listeners, Lee Phillips, is that right?
That's
been in touch with us to ask about that. And actually, that's a third person. But we've got so much on today that we'll have to just bump that along till we get a quieter week, because it certainly ain't this one. But yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of kind of freelance activity going on at the moment. I mean, have you done with George? You don't want to go through his all his, you know, curriculum vitae from his
curriculum
time in Dundee.
I will go back to his curriculum vitae and his time in Dundee, because, I mean, and I know this has got the whole sport thing coming up, but I do think it's absolutely significant that he was a lifelong Dundee United supporter until he went to stand in Glasgow Hillhead and then suddenly became a lifelong Celtic supporter. You know, and it's not a minor thing, that, as far as I'm concerned. As far as, it just says it all about the guy. He's a fabulist. I mean, his claim that he was brought up in the slums of Lochee. Well, I was brought up in Lochee. I mean, housing wasn't great in some areas, but I wouldn't have described it as slums. He was brought up in abject poverty. His father was a skilled craftsman at NCR who got promoted, expanded, and then became a teacher at, I think it was, the Harris Academy. So, I mean, you know, yeah, just a bit manipulative with the reality of his background, etc. But, I mean, as I say, it is the thing. There seems to be a coalescence of some people down in England who think he's actually going to be, as I say, this left-wing messiah coming in, who totally forget the people that he actually was involved with in All for Unity.
I suppose the larger thing was what he said on the night, which basically, this is one for Gaza.
Yep.
So whether that, you know, we already discussed that there is this organization that's planning to stand in lots of seats and is beginning to select candidates. I mean, that preceded George Galloway winning his seat. So I'd imagine these guys, if they had any sense, would kind of keep themselves well distant. I mean, whether they go ahead to stand in the seats, who knows, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, so that's, I guess that's their only worry, because, I mean, somebody had actually looked at the maths and discovered that it would need a really pretty major turnout or sort of switch, actually, of Muslim voters in key areas to affect Labour's expected majorities, because they are expected to win by a country mile in all sorts of places. But still, you know, there are certain seats where that could basically be enough to shift things. So, you know, who knows where that'll go.
Yeah, and bottom of the list was Simon Danchuk, the ex-Labour MP for Rochdale, who was standing for Reform, and their vote dropped. But, I mean, Rochdale has a really odd election history, being Liberal Democrat, and the whole anti-Labour vote seems to switch between the Lib Dems, the Tories, UKIP at one point. But there's been a big boost for, well, I presume it's a boost, and I think it probably would be regarded as such by Richard Tice, the leader of Reform, that Lee Anderson has jumped ship, because the current Conservative Party isn't quite anti-migration, anti-Muslim and right-wing enough for good old Lee, who's gone from the Labour Party to the Tories and has now joined Reform.
Yeah, whoop, whoop. I mean, just the first thing to say is, I mean, I'm kind of forcing myself to care, because I know it sort of matters in a distant sort of, you know, it's like a distant sort of reverberating way. But I mean, I did, just before we came on, just had a look, and actually at the last Well, have a guess, right, unless you've just had a look at what I tweeted. But what do you think Reform polled in the regional list percentage-wise at the last Holyrood elections in 2021?
God, I didn't see the tweet, but I would have thought maybe 1.5 to 2%.
Not 0.21%.
What?
Yes. And the point there was actually I was listening to The World at One on Radio 4 because I expected, you know, I thought I'm going to have to just listen to some of this stuff. And expectedly, Anderson would be topping the programme. But no. Can you guess what topped it?
Oh, not Kate Middleton and the fake photo.
Absolutely.
Oh,
20 yeah. minutes. 20
You're
minutes
kidding.
On it. Yeah. Four different interviews about it. You know, going through, I mean, just unbelievably, just nitpicking, boring, utterly irrelevant kind of, you know, speculation with ending up with some guy who was some royal correspondent talking about how, you know, they're all a bit crocked, basically, one way or another, and that this is a crisis in the monarchy, which is also a crisis, and here it comes, my absolute bête noire phrase, a crisis for the nation. Right, okay. First of all, there are four nations in the UK, but anyway... It's not, you know, in addition to the other sort of fake crises that we've got at the moment, you know, the crisis apparently of extremism on the streets, viz. Perfectly law-abiding marches of people protesting on behalf of the Palestinian people. We now have a completely fictitious crisis about monarchy based on, I don't know what's happened to Kate Middleton. Who knows where she is? But it just doesn't matter. And at the end, you know, we ended up at the end of the programme with a tiny bit about the expected defiance of Netanyahu to actually invade Palestine. You know, yeah. And it's sort of like you think, God almighty, does nobody who's a journalist feel embarrassed at that?
Obviously they don't, because, I mean, this is the whole thing about the agenda. I mean, when I looked at it, I thought, wait a minute, it started off with this tiny thing about two news agencies withdrawing the photograph because it said it had been altered in some kind of way. And I went, yeah, I mean, I don't know about you. I use my phone all the time and I go in and I crop and occasionally, you know, adjust the contrast and everything like that. And all these new other phones are available, Google phones. You can do all sorts of things about erasing and everything like that. And what the heck, you know?
I bet you've not... And neither, well, I'm betraying now that I have probably followed this a little bit more than you, but you haven't had an excuse, right, you know, called Cyprus.
Yes. But,
you know, if you kind of go on anything, you get this endless speculation that Kate isn't in the country, you know, is sort of half dead, you know, that they're basically making up that she's relatively okay when she's not. And there's massive conspiracies now being sort of blown air into about what her real state of health is. So that's the reason that they've managed to make this of some sort of interest is the kind of faux pas by the palace, realizing that this is now very sensitive because there was a picture released of her, I think, in the States or something, and then it wasn't allowed to be seen in Britain. I mean, you know, again,
yeah,
I haven't got the detail because I just thought I'm not really very interested. But that's the context of all this, that, you know, into this maelstrom, you put a cropped picture, which has got, you know, half of somebody's hand, apparently, or something else. Yeah. You know, it just was the surprise that the supposedly very on it, you know, Buckhouse had allowed. Anyway, look, here we are talking about it. Jesus,
but I mean, that,
it's just not.
Because, I mean, the thing about it is that, as you rightly said, it's the beginning of Ramadan. And we think the potential is that there will be an invasion, as you said, further invasion launched. And I don't know if you saw it. I mean, what struck me was that I saw the still photograph of aid being dropped simultaneously with bombs being dropped. And you think to yourself, well, you're going to spend 20 minutes on this because it's a crisis for the nation, and rather than actually examine what's going on in the real world, where the ramifications of what's going on in the Israel-Gaza-Palestinian situation are spreading right across the world and have significant political implications, not just in the UK, but right across Europe and in the United States of America for the potential that can happen there. And I'm sorry, that seems to me much more significant than...
Tittle tattle.
And speculation. I mean, is there anything, could you actually imagine, Leslie, and all your years of being a journalist, of actually being the person whose job was to be a royal correspondent? You know, I mean, you're saying to yourself, you know, go and report in the local flower show.
Well, I'll tell you something, because back in the day when I was, you know, a brownie reporter or whatever in London, I can't remember quite who was the royal correspondent, but it was before the days of Nick Witchell.
All right.
And actually, there was quite some skill involved in it, because the news would go live over to some poor person standing at where a train was meant to be arriving,
right,
with some royal person on it, whatever. There was no train. There was no information about when this train would arrive. And this guy had to fill for 3 or 4 minutes about what wasn't happening.
Yeah.
And that was actually happening all the time, because this was, you know, these guys, this was so non-news. And yet there would be a big chunk of time allocated to just, essentially, the headline was royalty.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing more complicated. Royalty arrives, royalty departs, royalty stands up, royalty sits down. That's all it was. And somebody had to make that into 3 minutes. So, I mean, I hope you appreciate, folks, you know, I'm not really meaning that. I think that's a tremendous thing to do with your life. But, you know, the creating empty meaning out of empty space.
Wow, yeah.
That is going on at the moment with all of this is quite something. And again, if you just listen to those news priorities there, 20 minutes Royals, 20 minutes Lee Anderson, is that Scotland?
No.
It sure ain't, you know. And going back to him, I mean, we can't use words like what we might use privately, you know. But I mean, jeez, you know, if you listen to this again, what is it? He just wants his country back. Oh, lamb.
Yes.
You know? And it's such a kind of petted dirt kind of, you know, pouted lip type, you know, presentation that he's got there. I quite appreciate that this feeds into a xenophobic kind of atmosphere that's been created by the Tories. So well done, guys. Because you created Lee Anderson. You created him in a whole lot of counts. You made him your blooming deputy of your, you know, party, because you were so scared of your own right wing. And you breathed life into the guy. You made him credible, and you made it news that he actually then dumped you and wandered off further right to reform UK. So, I mean, it's like, and then Theresa May disappearing. Oh, dear.
Oh,
dear,
yeah.
And, you know, what a noble woman and all this kind of bullshit, basically. I mean, she crashed us through God knows how much. She created the hostile environment.
Yep.
You know, all of you find yourself listening to this, you know, you're almost nodding off to sleep with it all, and then having to wake yourself up and go, I don't know anyone who feels like this about her or him or this or these priorities or this agenda or the whole damn lot now, you know. And yet there we go. The nation is worried about.
Yeah. And the nation is terribly upset that a portrait of Balfour was slashed and had paint thrown on it. Now, not something that I would do. But however, when you compare and contrast the utter destruction and devastation that's taken place in Gaza and the resultant starvation, you know, and you say to yourself, hang on a minute there. But again, that we lead into this whole thing of extremism. And we see the statements that come out from not just people like Suella Braverman, but Robert Jenrick and people like that, and Lee Anderson before he jumped ship, which is this whole extremist anti-Islam set of statements. And there's a whole lot of that going on just now. With it, particularly, I think we've got to begin with the Daily Telegraph article. Which I read and I was trying to get through my head, Lizzie. Maybe you can talk me through this. But was there an implication within the framework of the fact that they alleged that the money was originally going to go, it was 100 to 200,000, was originally going to go to UNICEF and had been sent to UNRWA instead? Was this a kind of a statement that because UNRWA at one point after the money had been allocated was then under investigation because of alleged Hamas connections, which had been totally blown out the water? Was there a kind of a suggestion there that Hamza Yousaf was filtering money to Hamas? I mean, was that the underlying tone of it, the connotation?
Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, I didn't even look at it particularly until the tweet appeared on Saturday from Hamza Yousaf, sort of responding to the Daily Telegraph headline, which is actually his response. I'm just looking at it now, has been liked 18,000 times. which is a lot. But he was kind of making the point that he thinks that what they were kind of up to was suggesting that he diverted the money in a way to guarantee the release of his relatives, his in-laws, who were basically stuck out there at the time. I mean, when you look through his his tweets, he makes the point that this absolutely was just not the business of release of hostages held or people held in Gaza was the decision of an entirely different agency completely. Mm-hmm. It had absolutely nothing to do with UNRWA, UNICEF or anybody else. I think people will actually, look at that exchange and just take from it, quite a lot, really. Because the next thing was Stephen Kerr. Did you get this bit?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well done, Martin Geisler, by the way.
Yeah, my good interview, which was on the Sunday show when Stephen Kerr was on talking about various things, actually mostly to do with the budget and the windfall tax, which we might somehow come back to. Yeah. My God, so much has happened. But on this particular thing, he had basically questioned the motivations of Humza Yousaf in making the award of money. And suggested there was a conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. Well, as Humza Yousaf has kept saying, well, not really, because like most governments at that point were giving money to UNRWA. So, that was a pretty normal thing to do. The rest of it, what's your point? But Stephen Kerr just kind of banged on and on, wouldn't change his language. He was pointed out by Martin Geisler that this is exactly the kind of inflammatory, kind of horrible stuff that and he'd said, if you actually look at some of the responses that Humza Yousaf's had online, a lot of them are pretty horrible. He stands by that. So God love you, mate, because probably you're out anyway. So,
Well, that's an interesting one, because Keith Brown has asked, the Conservative Party, this guy's a prospective parliamentary candidate. Do you stand by him? And in the current climate, they probably say, no, we don't need to be not stand by him. We have to wholeheartedly support him in what he's been saying, because it's in the Daily Telegraph, of course, as well, and that's their house journal. But talking of Keith Brown, the other thing happened, the article you recently wrote, which was that was floating about and was particularly suggested by Keith Brown in the Sunday National, was that they should examine the abstentionist position that Sinn Féin has taken up since its founding of not taking up seats. An interesting one, because I'm kind of torn on this, because when I watched what happened with the Hoyle debacle, and then the second element, which you and I watched live, which was the whole unfolding of, oh, this debate's going to allow the SNP to put their points in, and then, did it heck. I kept thinking to myself, what the dickens are we doing there? The we being the SNP, even though I'm not a member, but these are representatives of the democratic decisions of the Scottish people, and sending all these constituency MPs down there to be totally blanked, ignored, ridiculed. And why are we doing it? So I'm kind of genuinely on the fence about it. I really am.
Well, yes, the thing that the column I'd written, which was just the day after the second kicking sand in the face of Stephen Flynn episode, was really asking, well, what do you do now? Because, that's fine that he had said himself, abstentionism is not leadership. Mm-hmm. That's Stephen Flynn talking about the Tory stance on Palestine, but presumably also the SNP stance on Westminster. And then actually Alan Smith had popped up later and saying that a failure to articulate the new Gaza policy would leave people entitled to conclude this place really is just a sick pantomime. But then why stay in a sick pantomime? And if disengagement, this was the other rumour that there was going to be some disengagement protest that would mean that SNP MPs would refuse to take part in some debates or sit in Commons committees. And, you can see the problem with that, because like nobody would notice, basically.
Yeah.
That's like a tree falling in a forest that nobody occupies. Doesn't make a sound. So if that's out, disengagement, and then abstentionism is out, because Stephen Flynn doesn't want that sort of strategy, what's in? And the thing is, there's got to be something in, because just otherwise, just standing and taking the pain, gosh, this reminds me of strange boxing matches I sat up watching mm-hmm. with my dad when I was very young.
Yeah.
But, you know, just standing right, basically on the ropes, just taking the pain, you know, there's what's that doing for anybody? It's not. They're looking at it the other way around, which is to say, you know, if we left, then what would be the point in anybody voting for the SNP at the next election, the general election? Of course, you know, there's meant to be a campaign happening at the moment by the SNP in advance of that election. I can quite see from, if you look on social media, you'll see quite a lot of tweets about people out canvassing. So mm-hmm. I imagine that's the campaign as it usually is, which is, you know, a lot of feet on the ground and, you know, going around doors and so on. But that's not what was voted for at the conference. It was a campaign about independence.
Yeah.
So we're not having that at the moment, which is noticeable. And so, you know, we're not then having got to the point where there's been a challenge to the ability of Lindsay Hoyle to stay as Speaker, that seems to have now failed. Mm-hmm. You know, he's still there. I mean, by the time I'd finished the column, I can't remember, I should have checked this before where we are now, but I mean, I can't remember if it was 81 or 89 people, which is completely unprecedented, actually, for a Speaker to have those many letters of, you know, wanting him to stand down and just paying no attention to it. And this should, I mean, obviously should worry everyone, because this is how Labour hang.
Yeah.
You know, this is going to be it from here on in. It doesn't matter how many rules you break or how many sort of the wee guys you push to the side or whatever, you know, and this is before they're even a government. You can just go in, flex your muscles, do anything to avoid having debates that you find uncomfortable, which, just by the by, because there's no outlet in a proper democratic way for the people, particularly south of the border, who want to see movement on Palestine. Mm-hmm. There's no conduit for that in their country at all, right? None. So, you know, you shout louder and louder and louder. And if there is this permanent disconnect now on so many different issues, but particularly, obviously, Palestine is one of them, you know, welcome to the next 5 years. Because that's what it's going to be like every blinking which way. And that's just on that very topical sort of foreign issue. But if you start looking at stuff, you know, Rachel Reeves has now ruled out any sort of, you know, since the Conservatives cutely implemented some of the big measures which were built into Labour's spending plans, which were going to allow them to do some good things about state spending. You know, kind of the phasing out the non-dom status. I mean, that's mm-hmm. now gone. So, you know, that leaves Labour scrambling to find out how to even fund commitments they've made, like free breakfast for school kids and improvements in the NHS and so on. And they've said no increases in taxation and they'll grow the economy. Well, good luck with that, honey.
Yeah.
It's pretty grim. But when you've challenged somebody, and this is probably why, I don't know, but Ian Blackford, you know, apart from that rush of blood to the heat of 2018 or whatever it was, but, you know, why they don't challenge, because if there's nowhere else to go, then you're left looking a wee bit stupid, to be blunt, actually, or looking that you have no strategy, or looking like you can't have a strategy, because what can you do? And, there was a possibility, I heard it mentioned by a couple of people, that it could have disrupted the budget. Now, I can quite see how that could have run. You know, it would have been dismissed as childish or whatever. But I don't know if anybody even discussed it. And then because Keith Brown actually came out a couple of days afterwards and had basically said he thought there was a case actually for, trying to decide whether mm-hmm. there was a point in taking seats in Westminster, which Stephen Flynn really kind of took very badly.
Yes.
And it's kind of like there's not even a strategy happening within the SNP across to the two bits of the party. If you're to look at all of that, you would think, well, OK, that was, you were awfully angry. you were awfully convincing. You were awfully right, actually, when it came to Gaza and so on. And what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's an echoing vacuum of what goes on at Westminster. Yeah. You're shouting into the void down there because you are going to be completely ignored. And the only other aspect of it is if you have a slightly less than stellar general election, that will be held against you. If you have a tremendous general election in the SNP, nah, who cares? Because we can just do what we like. But the other thing, well, when you were talking about Rachel Reeves there, was the fact that she has come out and said, and it looks as if on this issue and another issue we'll be talking about, that Labour are utterly committed to the current spending policy and debt reduction of the Conservatives. Because, I mean, I looked at it, the growth was projected to be 0.8% 2024, 1.9% in 2025. And when you take a look at it, and the Labour Party is going to be inheriting and then continue with policies, which compare and contrast, for example, in the Eurozone, they're on 3% growth. The USA, wait for this, 8.2%. growth, you know, and we're on 0.8. And one of the big things that Hunt said, but look how much we've reduced debt. We've got the second lowest level of debt in the G7, less than Japan, France, or the USA. Japan growth just under 3%, France 2%, USA growth 8.2%. Has no one turned around in the Labour Party and actually made a connection about the fact that debt in itself is not a bad thing if you're utilising it for the correct reasons? And who are you borrowing it from? Well, usually you're borrowing it from your own central bank. So who do you owe the money to? Yourself. So what we do is we go into debt to invest, to grow the economy in order to get people back to work. And you get the whole virtuous circle of the multiplier effect from back in the old Keynesian economics that goes on. And that's the way you grow yourself out of recession. That's what Roosevelt did in the New Deal in the States. You know, and you're saying to yourself that the Labour Party is absolutely enthralled to this whole concept of we've got to operate within the regime that's been set down arbitrarily by the Conservatives, and we're only going to be taken seriously if we stick to it. And we've spoken to business on this. Yeah, well, okay, Rachel, we'll just wait and see.
And actually, William Thompson was tweeting about a phrase she used, which I think Keir Starmer may have used, but she certainly did, about not being able to max out the country's credit card, which, as he pointed out, just you know, relating to the podcast we did with him and the Scottonomics stuff and what you've just said there, it's just a completely crazy view of how the economy works. And I think actually people had said there was incumbent upon the BBC and other people is not allowing just absolute false narratives to kind of get trundled out without being challenged, which they're not. Just by the by, the budget, I mean, again, I don't think feel like I didn't spend enough time on this. But the other thing, if we're just to kind of continue the theme of the amount of sand that's being kicked in Scotland's face.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Scotland's share with 3.5% of spending.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, that's, you know, and that's you kind of being front footed and a bit scary. Kind of it does make you just wonder, really. I've got to say what the point is.
Yeah. And Canary Wharf gets more than Wales and almost as much as Scotland. You know, and you're saying, well, that's it. Yeah, because that's, I mean, and no harm to folk in London. But I mean, there just seems to be this utter concentration. And that's the regard we're held in, where a small area in London gets more than Wales and almost as much as Scotland. And I know that I'm probably exaggerating the almost as much, but there wasn't a kick in the arse off it. Mm. But I mean, when I looked at the rest of the budget, I mean, it was meh. I mean, this whole thing about national insurance as well. And again, Victoria Derbyshire, big thumbs up to Victoria Derbyshire, when she talked about who's going to be better off, who's going to be worse off, and actually coming up with the facts and figures to actually challenge the government spokesman on the fact that when you actually analyse with the tax that's thresholds and freezes and everything like that, people at the lower end are going to be worse off. And when the other thing you would look about it in terms of household disposable income that I noticed, between 2019 and 2023, for the first time since the start of records in 1955, household disposable income shrank. It went down. It was in minus. And when you actually look at all the other figures, even prior to Boris Johnson, there was growth in household disposable income, and they're patting themselves on the back for the inflation that was entirely caused by external events elsewhere. Now it's coming down, it's entirely down to the operation of the UK government in getting inflation down. But always remember, folks, as you're well aware, inflation coming down means prices are rising less. But we're not going up as fast as they were before. They're not coming
so
down.
It's still dreadful. It's just not as dreadful as
it was, yeah.
But then that's an interesting thing too, though, this sort of duking about on who's the losers from the budget. Yeah. Because you say the real losers, are those on low pay, disguised by Jeremy Hunt's claim that the losers were non-doms, right, nobody weeping there, and Scotland's oil industry.
Yes.
Now, that's been another interesting one, which was indeed why Stephen Kerr from the Tories was on the Sunday show in the first place, which was basically to say, you guys have got essentially less clout than the SNP at Westminster.
Yes.
You know, you're just, you know, because you had made it a really big deal that the extension of the windfall tax by 1 year was going to be absolutely cataclysmic, dreadful. And, you know, the Tories were the only guys that you could trust with oil and gas. And then not only does Jeremy Hunt, you know, increase it for another year, but he actually says the Scottish oil industry is one of the two biggest losers. So it wasn't kind of like, you know, a big boy did it and ran away. This is a sort of very conscious, we don't care about you. And actually, there was a very interesting chap came on. I'm going to pronounce his name wrongly, I think, Professor Paul de Leeuwen, who's, I think, Dutch from that name and is at Aberdeen University. Because, you know, again, a lot of people will be thinking, I don't know what we think about this windfall tax.
Exactly.
Because, you know, we're still not even at the levels of windfall tax the Norwegians have and so on. So it's kind of like then there is this argument about, is the SNP's problem with the windfall tax only that it would be spent on English nuclear power stations, which, okay, is pointless, annoying and whatever. But still, there are bigger fish to fry at the back of it all. I mean, this guy actually did a really good kind of connection of the whole thing and talked about the total need for investment and, you know, back to the idea of a transition, like planning, like strategy. Some of the figures he had were quite mind-blowing. He was saying on renewables, we need to be installing one wind turbine every day for the next decade. That's what should be happening if we're going to shift the way we need to shift. On hydrogen, we should be putting in an electrolyzer every couple of days. And the we in that is the British government.
Right.
So, you know, because they control energy. So he was basically making the point that there's nowhere near enough investing going on. He was calling for, you know, in the same way as there's the Office of Budget Responsibility, which took a lot of decisions out of the hands of government and politicians. OK, arguable in its effectiveness and blah, blah, blah. But he's saying, really, we should have an Office of Energy Planning, which takes energy right away from politicians because they have had four tax changes, the Tories, in the last couple of years. And it's all the chopping and changing that basically makes it impossible for people to plan. So he's talking about a long-term integrated plan that shifts you out of oil and gas and into renewables with the investment going in at enough of a pace to shift the workforce over.
Yeah.
And none of that is happening, but nobody ever even queries this with them. That, you know, the heat is always applied to what is, and it's kind of justifiable heat. What is the Scottish government doing? I don't know if we did or didn't cover a piece that Simon Forrest wrote, who is...
Yes, we did, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, that was looking at the lack of canniness on the Scottish government's part of installing in contracts the requirement to actually use a certain proportion of Scottish-generated jobs or materials or whatever, common across the world. So for sure, there's missed opportunities by the Scottish government. But blow me, the massive, massive one is the massive miss that's coming from Westminster on this.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, it was the, I'm with you on it because I had to think my way through I mean, I'm all in favour of taxing these super profits that people are making. But then the whole, and I thought to myself, well, wait a minute here, is this playing politics in terms of we want to establish the SNP in the Northeast, we want to secure seats there, we want to get rid of Douglas Ross. And then when you have it explained in that kind of way. But again, it is this whole thing, and I keep coming down to it, Leslie, it's the frustration of being tied within a framework of the United Kingdom and whichever government gets in, you know, because I hope this isn't too big a leap away from the budget and the proposals contained within that. But again, I was reflecting on that fact when we were talking about the budget, about Labour going along with it. And it looks as if Labour will not oppose any of the new measures that Michael Gove will be proposing concerning definitions of extremism. And it was a funny one because, I mean, the Prevent scheme, I'm surprised they actually go back into the country. You know, I thought in my passport, because it says they've added socialism, communism, anti-fascism, anti-abortion, okay, as political indicators of ideologies that could lead to terrorism. You know, and I'm thinking, well, of course, the Labour Party aren't going to be that fussed because they gave up on socialism, you know, with the election of Starmer. I mean, that's long. I mean, whether there was any great core of socialism after getting rid of Clause 4 is not open to debate, I don't think. But with Corbyn, yeah, it might have come back. But there is no pretense at socialism in the Labour Party. But I mean, I was looking, this is all down to the Shawcross report into extremism. And some of the folk behind this, I mean, there's this guy, Robin Simcox, I don't know if you saw him, who's the government commissioner for combating terrorism, the anti-extremists are. He's the one that came up with the fact that when he was asked about this new definition of extremism, said, we will not have an authoritarian state if London is no longer permitted to be a no-go zone for Jews every weekend. Mm-hmm. And this guy comes from the Henry Jackson Society, and he blames the ills. I mean, he's been very clear about this. He said, we've had a three-decade-long failed policy of mass migration and multiculturalism. And this is the man who was appointed by Priti Patel to counter extremism. And this is the report by William Shawcross that they've all cooperated in that may seem, says that if you challenge British institutions, I mean, is that challenging the royal family? We'll be investigating for our podcast here about the royal family now and in the past. Is it about, yeah, let's get rid of the House of Lords? You're challenging a British institution. Or is it the very fact they're utilising what you talked about is that political vacuum in England where people are now coming out in the streets because there's no other vehicle to express their disgust and their distaste for the Zionist project and what's going on in Gaza?
Yeah, it's crazy. And actually, the interesting thing is that three former Home Secretaries have warned that Gove's kind of idea about this extremism stuff that will come out on Thursday is looking wobbly. And they're warning that he needs to find as broad a consensus as possible, which is, you know, and not to use the issue as a political football to seek short-term tactical advantage. You know, I mean, this is quite strong stuff. Yeah. They've got the government's advisor on political violence. You know, a whole lot of different advisors have basically signed the letter, as well as the ex-army chief, Lord Richard Dannett, who, you know, says strangely comes out with quite sensible things at times. Yes. But anyway, this is the front page of The Guardian. And apparently even Priti Patel is in on, you know, this sort of, you know, worrying about the phrasing, basically saying it's really important that we do not malign the wrong people through the wrong definitions. So, like, how wrong can you get when you've got Priti Patel on the other side of the thing? You know, it's just extraordinary. And I mean, if blimmin' Gordon Brown couldn't come up with a definition of Britishness, and he couldn't, you know, when he was trying to do his, you know, British jobs for British workers or whatever it was, and trying to kind of fly the flag and all the rest of it, he was trying to come up with, you know, rules and tests that could easily be applied, which actually I can seem to remember most British people couldn't pass.
No.
You know, they were so stringent. So, and they actually didn't really relate to being British, because you could say, what is being British? You know, back to our the nation, It's a state, honey. It's just not a nation. Nations have characteristics about culture and stuff that's memorable and meaningful and kind of purposeful. But states have exchequers and budgets and tax claims. And that's not really the kind of stuff that people tend to memorize or feel important in their lives. So good luck to these guys. I mean, I almost feel, yeah, bring it on, mate, because this is so wrong where he's going with this. But actually, just to be kind of, you know, grown up about it, also so dangerous.
Yes.
And that's what is really beginning to exercise lots of people. I mean, I heard Keith Brown on Good Morning Scotland today, and he was blooming incandescent, you know, actually about Stephen Kerr. But also just he said both he and Stephen Kerr have had, you know, I'm not sure if it was death threats, but, you know, big threats to their safety as a result of things they've said. So if you keep inflaming, yeah, you know, what happens? You got kind of, you get the major news sequences are just going over and over and over this unsubstantiated claim that people are living in total fear and that London is a no-go area for Jews. Now, I mean, I've got Jewish friends and they are feeling jumpy. I've got, you know, a couple quite happy that they're actually living in Scotland, not south of the border. But, you know, this is because we've now got a cauldron with a non-functioning government at the centre of it. And, you know, it'd be fair to say there's been big demonstrations, actually, and ructions caused. And as you said, challenges to governments all over the world, such that Joe Biden's had to come up with this not very viable looking plan to create a kind of new harbour that can take aid for Gaza. When, as everybody's pointed out, there are perfectly functioning harbours that could docks that could do the same thing on the Israel side, you know, within a couple of miles. And the heat needs to be put on to allow the Americans could do it so easily. So all that shows everybody is an unwillingness to basically say, we just stop the weapons.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reality of it. I mean, and I saw that bizarre, it wasn't a news conference, where Biden was in the ice cream parlor.
It was weird.
And standing with his ice cream in hand, almost like a microphone, and talking into it and saying that there was going to be a Monday, Tuesday, and that's long gone past now. But as you rightly said, the whole idea is, who's providing the weapons? Who's providing the money? And it's the reality is that there is, with the collusion of the Israeli Defence Force, there are protesters at the border. And I've seen some of the interviews with them, and it's just mind-blowing to actually... To hear the racist rhetoric coming out the mouths of these very ordinary Israelis who are definitely stopping aid getting through, of the limited aid that's trying to get through. And when you see that again, you see the photographs of the mass queues of people that there are. It becomes incoherent. But again, being more coherent on this, to stick with Biden, his State of the Union address, I mean, the expectations were low, and he greatly exceeded them with one limited faux pas about a pin that he was given. He got a name wrong. He actually sounded lively. And to be honest about him, when I heard the Trump speech in Mar-a-Lago after Super Tuesday, he sounded darn sight more sprightly and smarter and more articulate than Donald Trump did. Sounded a lot more awake.
Yeah, well, but listen to us, you know, this is like the future of the world hinges on men who are just, you know, the question is which one sounds, you know, slightly more awake than the other one. And I still think that, the kind of moves that he's been making with the Inflation Reduction Act, which has contributed to a green transition, to an economy that's, as you described it, is actually growing at the moment, and so on. There's obviously a collegiate approach to government with Biden, because clearly he's not perky enough to be running around doing this all himself, you know. So actually the good news is that there's kind of quite a few hands on the tiller, which actually is also good news for any kind of government. The fear then is, you know, obviously the fear is just the fear. You just have to say the word Trump and it's fear all the way around, you know. And nobody needs it rehearsed, because you'll have seen it and heard it, you know, whether it's from Ukraine, from, you know, from Europe having to think, you know, really take seriously that this looks like it could be on the cards now, a return of Trump, that therefore Europe needs to take care of its own defence, that therefore the Germans need to undo attitudes that they have had since basically Hitler. Well, let me just qualify that in the sense of the appalling legacy of Hitler has left the Germans incredibly unwilling to get involved in any war, and also particularly with Russia, you know. So there's all sorts of stuff that's going to, people are going to have to get their heads around if this works its way through. And every program has had folk on trying to make sense of what looks like it's nonsensical, which is why anybody, I mean, there's a great thing running on Twitter at the moment. I wish I could remember the guy's name, Saul. He's an interviewer on an American chat show. And he starts the whole thing off with just a sort of 2-minute resume of, well, what's so wrong with Trump? And just runs through everything, you know, the whole nine yards. And every time you think he's finished, he starts again because there's more and more and more. So it does beg a belief. It shows you in a way what people who are primed in a certain way, voters who are primed to think that they are being excluded, will simply not respond to any kind of statistics that sound like they relate to what they've been primed to think of as the entitled few, which are not them. Mm-hmm. And so here we are sitting with all of that. I mean, I must say, last night at the Oscars, just on this thing about the attitudes of Jewish people being quite varied, the British director who won the strangely best international film for a film I've got to say I'll never be going to see, which is The Zone of Interest, that's set in Auschwitz. But he said he's Jewish, and he said he totally refuted that his Jewishness and the Holocaust was being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people. So yeah, that doesn't quite make sense, but you know, he was really kind of saying he supports basically the people of Gaza. So there's just so much that's on the go with this. And of course, we forgot to say that with Lee Anderson, his suspension by the Tories was claiming that Islamists had got control of Sadiq Khan. And, you know, listening to what's his name, Richard Tice, the head of Reform UK on the World at One, when, you know, today in their 20-minute slot, when he was asked repeatedly as a leader of the party, did he agree that Islamists have got control of Sadiq Khan? And he just wouldn't answer it about four or five times, and finally said perhaps the language had been a little bit, you know, exaggerated, but everybody basically knew what he meant.
Yeah.
Dear, dear. I mean, Thursday's going to be interesting, actually, to see how this pans out. And I mean, well, again, you know, I'm sure that the SNP will have a strong position on this, but the stronger thing is just, does anybody in Scotland really feel that this debate is live for us? I hope I'm not being complacent here. I really am, because I don't get out much. You know, well, actually, I do go running around with the film and that. But, you know, only to certain, you know, I'm not exactly standing on street corners at 10 o'clock at night, you know. So I don't know. But I mean, and this is always what happens with a government that's about to be, you know, totally eradicated. I mean, this is the last ditch, a kind of manipulation of the public. It's the most horrible leaving present for the next guys. Mm-hmm. Is just souring the well completely, so that people aren't even interested in discussing the big stuff that's the economy. Although I'd quite wager that if you did have a proper discussion about some of this stuff, you know, if the World at One had just had different priorities today, that would have been pretty interesting too. But no, we pad this all out.
Yeah. I mean, we've not been padding out at all, because, I mean, when you said maligning, it's something I've got to talk about as well, because it was apparent to me when I was awake, it came up in the news feeds, where we've actually had a government minister, Michelle Donnellan, she's settled, and it's been £15,000 because she accused Professor Kate Sang of Heriot-Watt University and Dr. Kamna Patel of University College London. And again, this is this whole thing. She accused them of encouraging terrorism. Yeah. And she tweeted, and it was based upon a policy exchange report. Now, people don't know about the policy exchange. You should know about the policy exchange because these people are absolutely central to the thought processes and the ideologies and the policies of the current Conservative government. They are the big think tank. They genuinely are. And they produced this report. And what Donnellan did was then she then got in touch with the UK Research and Innovation Institute to say you shouldn't be, these women should not be employed as part of a consultancy group on diversity and inclusion. They were immediately suspended by UKRI, suspension subsequently lifted. And then to put the tin hat on it, Donnellan, the £15,000, because there was a libel case going to be taken out against her, we've paid for it. And the excuse that I think it was Penny Mordaunt came up with was the fact that, of course, because, you know, she's such a nice person, she didn't take her redundancy money after being education secretary or something like that for like 36 hours. And she didn't take her redundancy money. And that kind of covered for the fact, you know, that she was. And you're saying to yourself, this is exactly what you said. It is the dog days of an utterly useless government. And it's just, it is all fizzling out. But as you, and you're saying they're kicking the can down the road and laying traps for a not very courageous Labour Party to step into later on.
Yeah, yes, that is about the size of it. It's all pretty depressing.
And yeah, well,
it's just something upbeat to say. In fact, yeah, I've got a recommendation.
I've got upbeat stuff
to
say to you
as well.
End. You know, I've got upbeat to say to you, and I'm not going to blow smoke up you here, but you were International Women's Day, Role of Honour, Leslie Riddick, and it's a stellar Role of Honour when I looked at it. Some great names there, Margot MacDonald, Winnie Ewing, yourself. And the other thing which I thought was really important, I'd like to get your reflection on this. In 1995, you produced the Scots Women Edition, and in 2024, Laura Webster of the National, and I've got this glory by association with me, one of my ex-students, they reproduced that. And this came about after a conversation that she had with you last summer. And I mean, how do you feel? I mean, how do you feel about the fact that that's now nearly 30 years ago? Have things changed sufficiently? And you must be feeling, I mean, being honestly, you must be feeling great about the fact that a new generation's come along editing a national newspaper and they've gone back to do what you did nearly 30 years ago.
Well, yes. I mean, in a way, the point of doing the Scots Women all that time ago was slightly to kind of throw a bit of a, you know, spotlight on how papers are different when they're edited by different sets of people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that just one-off thing, which actually became a two-off thing because it was there the next year as well, that does, you know, it's not enough really to kind of tweak an agenda particularly. Now we're in a situation that is so different. And actually in the conversations I had with Laura, what really struck me was how we're just in a different world altogether. I was going through the stuff we'd done in both the Scots Women's. And okay, this probably reflects me a lot because I quite like being a bit provocative and sort of not, you know, not predictable. So, for example, in the main Scots Women in 1995, there was a fashion page which featured, I almost feel ashamed to say this, a man fundamentally not wearing very much in five different positions, showing how important it was to match your briefcase and your shoes. Now, that came from a piece that had happened 3 weeks earlier, a real thing in the Scotsman, the normal Scotsman, where the fashion page, a full broadsheet page, was devoted to a piece saying how important it was for women to match their handbags and their shoes with a model who was wearing nothing in the Scotsman, which is like, what? You know, so I mean, this is the kind of thing you might get from the Sun or whatever. And those of us on the paper who complained about it and just said, this is pretty gratuitous and sort of embarrassing, actually, were just told, as usual, where's your sense of humour? And I thought at the time, I know where it is.
Yeah.
So we got this guy who actually reveled in the thing. We went to Jenner's and Jenner's were hugely up for it and came up with all sorts of matching briefcases and shoes. We only planned to do one picture, but your man was quite up for getting five different positions. So we had this whole page of him covering his modesty, but only just, you know. And the point was, it was a complete sort of pastiche of what is utterly unremarkable at that time. And actually, last night, I've got to say, I never really watched this series, Prime Suspect, but I was watching it from the 1980s with, you know, the shoulder pads and Helen Mirren looking 12 and all sorts of people looking extremely young. But it reminded me of just the absolute misogyny that you kind of, if you got anywhere near the upper echelons of anything, you were just faced with this wall of hostility, you know, or just complete indifference, you know, indifference at best, hostility at worst. So looking back at all of that, the point was to try to sort of do something that would really be provocative and would be, as you would say, a talker. So people would go, Jesus, do you see that page 5? I mean, fucking hell, that's a bit, you know, I mean, and then discuss it. I don't know. Is that gratuitous crap? It might have been, but you're allowed to try and do stuff. You're allowed to, I think in one, we made up a poll to kind of support that page, you know, and somebody had got very annoyed. It was something to do with, you know, what men carry in their briefcases. Someone got very annoyed at the idea I'd spent good money on such a ludicrous piece of nonsense. And I said, no, of course I didn't. I made it up. And of course, then they got even angrier because, you know, you're not meant to. And I said, don't you realize all these polls are made up?
Yeah.
You know, all the stuff that says 2 out of 3 women feel this and that to justify a page 3, that's all made up. You know, so it's kind of like, that's where we were 25 years ago with a lot of, you know, a lot of possibly on the edgy kind of humor, you'd have to say. And I've got to say, Laura's face just, you know,
I can imagine, just
no way you could get with even the debates there are now about what constitutes female womanness and all the rest of it. There's no way you can get, you know, roll around having, you know, provocative pokes at guys, you know, double standards or anything like that. So I think it's quite hard to create something that is a talker when you do something that doesn't look as different as that paper really did look very different. Yeah. And final thing to say is papers. I mean, back then, you know, we sold 125,000 copies of The Scotswoman in 1995, and we could have sold probably 3 to 4 times that number if the circulation department of the Scotsman hadn't decided against orders to just not increase the print run. So it sold out in half an hour. And that's what I mean about just the sort of quiet, sullen anger of guys who hate what you're doing. So even, you know, it's unbelievable, really, that they could just, oh, gosh, we forgot. Right. OK. So now, I mean, no paper gets anywhere near 125,000 daily circulation. That's probably the combined total for absolutely every paper that's sold in Scotland. And maybe that's even exceeds it. So it's a really difficult thing to create a moment with a paper because relatively so few people are actually buying, particularly buying the flappy, you know, physical paper. So that made me all the more impressed that Laura was walking into that environment and was still prepared to try and do something different. And indeed, I should say that that was followed up with an appeal that anybody who's listening to all of this about Gaza, you know, it's one thing to get very angry about it and everything, but come on, if you've got 10 quid, 5 quid, any quid, give it to the medical aid for Palestinians. I think I've got that right, but you'll find it basically all over social media. And that's an appeal that the National is championing. So, you know, just give money now because there isn't tomorrow on this.
No. And yeah, exactly. And when I was in Cyprus, I thought I'd escaped. I thought I'd gone someplace very, very different. And there I was at the Chrysopolitissa Basilica, the remnants of it. And I glanced down and there is a plaque. And I thought, if I'm wondering where I'm going with this, folks, it was to King Erik Ejegod of Denmark, who died in Paphos, where I was on my holidays, in 1103. So he's on his way, and things never change. He was on his way to the Middle East at that point, on a crusade, I assume. So there I was, Denmark. And this is me crossing the ball for you to head into the net with the Denmark film, which you showed at Holyrood.
Yes, because people had noticed, I think I may have said, you know, that so far there's only been one MSP at 22 screenings, which have all been sold out, which is a kind of low whack rate. And I think once people have seen the film, you know, there's so much raised in it, it encapsulates an awful lot, particularly of where we would like to be going, basically, that people immediately want to know that our legislators are actually seeing it, because it's one thing to have your consciousness raised as a punter. But, you know, if it's not connecting with, you know, MSPs, then what? So, you know, big thanks to Ivan McKee and Jane Denham and his office who put this on fairly quickly. And there was about 40 people turned up. There was 4 ministers, about 15 MSPs, and the rest were parliamentary staff. So it was great that they saw it all. I have to say, I realise that obviously I go and do probably quite a lot of talks in places where people, it would have to be said, God love you, you have come a few times over the years. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's always somebody who doesn't realise we don't have local government in Scotland, for example, but definitely there's quite a lot of people who just go, right, wake me up when she's finished, because they've heard it before,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Now, the weird thing is that talking to this audience of MSPs, I don't think they'd heard any of it. And that's partly that because it's not, there's a complete separation, I think, honestly, between MSPs and the wider Yes movement. These guys, okay, they're busy, but they live in definitely a world and a bubble of their own. I suppose you could say, to be fair, we live in a different bubble because mm-hmm. we don't know the in-depth goings on in Parliament every day. But I mean, I spoke to a couple of people just mentioning that there's a Believe in Scotland march coming up and an All Under One Banner one that's a couple of weeks apart, which is a bit, God, can we just not do this? Mm-hmm. And actually, they were completely unaware of either of them happening. Some of the stuff I was chucking out there, I realised came from Blossom, which was published in 2013. None of these guys came to those events either. So yeah. that's quite a lot of repeat, some of it repeat information, you know, restyled in different contexts, bloody, you know, all of that. Mm-hmm. That's basically been the best part of 10 years that many people listening to this podcast will feel they could sort of recite by heart. And yet it was kind of, there were some slack-jawed, what's going on? And I thought, God almighty, if anybody really is thinking that there's going to be there's a lot of radical soul searching going on in terms of policy direction, I don't think it's there. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty serious in a whole lot of ways, you know, much more serious than for us, because it's what yeah. we should be able to do something about, perhaps, than much of everything else we've spoken about. And I don't really know where that's going. If anybody wants to start their kind of Alba's the Answer chorus, well, you're entitled to that opinion.
Yep.
But this is a pretty fundamental problem. There's 2 years to go before Scottish Parliament elections. You know, there needs to be a much more vigorous approach to what that Parliament can do. And it's not there.
Yeah, I didn't interject there at all, Leslie, because I was actually completely and utterly taken aback about that lack of political awareness amongst the people who are elected politicians. I'm sorry, that's thrown me completely. I mean,
did me, I've got to say. And I mean, I was checking it out with a few people, and there's just, I mean, obviously, everybody in that position has learned to just wing it pretty well. Hey, we're no strangers to that ourselves.
No, I was going to say, yeah.
You know, so that you can manage a kind of interested looking nod when somebody comes up with something that fundamentally you've got no idea about. Mm-hmm. But I do remember for the very short period when I was back to the Scotswoman, I was, what was it, assistant editor or deputy editor at the Scotswoman at one point. And it's very useful to have a management role, as you may appreciate at some point, because it completely disabuses you of the notion that managers have got a clue what's going on.
Yes.
And, you know, people would kind of come in and say, well, I said this to you 3 months ago and, you know, I sent you an email about that. And you feel like saying to them, can I just turn my computer around until you see the 1,000 emails I haven't even answered mm-hmm. yet about any of this? And it's that kind of impossibility, in a way, unless there's a really concerted effort by a leadership team to pull their heads out of something in a very planned, concerted way. You just can't do more than just bat through. I mean, Andy Whiteman said this. Mm-hmm. That when he was, you know, spending his time and people will know how dedicated, you know, talented in the art of trying to see what possible amendments could happen. And he found himself drowning in detail on stuff that was important for somebody, but just wasn't why he'd gone into politics. So, I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but I think it's the same as that management moment where, I mean, I say to everybody, if I haven't answered you in a week, can you bug me? Because that's not you being annoying. That's you being dead useful. Because the last thing I want is to forget things, but I will inevitably forget things. There's just one of me. These guys are having to keep up the impression that they're able to kind of handle, you know, the subtle points of every discourse. I would suggest that that mismatch between Keith Brown and Stephen Flynn on, you know, whether or not to leave Westminster suggests just if these guys can't even sort of get a unified line established within one political party, there's no way they're going to be picking up subtle bits about what the Yes Movement said about that, or what Believe in Scotland thinks about that, or what March is on and whether it's important. I mean, they'll find out soon enough because I think Hamza is speaking at the Believe in Scotland's one. But, you know, it's sort of, it's not what you think.
No, it's not what you think. I think that may be the title of this week's podcast. It's not what you think. But it is. I mean, and this has been, I'm just looking at it, it's a 1 hour, 10 minute bumper edition. And because because it's been, for me anyway, as my guy used to say after they'd been away for a wee break, it was back to Al Clazen porridge for me this week. And on that very couthy Dundonian note, we'll see you next week, Chums.